Okay, this is Mr. John Steele, and he's going to tell me a little bit about his family history and what they did and how that's been important.
My mother was born in St. Martin's, New Brunswick, and she lived out there until the Kennedys moved to Rossi and opened the Kennedy House here. And my father originally came from Brockville, Ontario, and his family before that were in the Hudson Bay Trading Company. And one of the ancestors was a factor in the Moose Factory, Hudson Bay place. And when my father was working in the bank, he came down here and met my mother. And that started a whole bunch of steals. And there were seven boys and a girl in that union. And since then, there's been a lot more, but I couldn't tell you all about those people because they're just they're too numerous. He was in the bank, and he stayed in the bank.
I know that your mother was a Kennedy. Yeah. Tell me about what you recall that are different from the
Kennedy. Arthur Kennedy, and the Kennedy house, and the garage and stable, which it was before it was a garage, it was a stable. Well, I think the eyes and ears and heart of Rossi, because if anybody wanted to know anything, they called there. That's where the telephone office was. The Carrie Williams and the Pierce girls were the operators there, and so if you wanted to know anything, you would call them, and then they would get in touch with either the garage or the house. And that's when you find out where people were, the plumber and the electrician and things like that. And then the Kennedy House used to, well, it eventually became with my hotel, and then it eventually became inhabited by mostly widows, and it was just like a family there, and every morning and every afternoon they had tea together and in the kitchen, you know, and anybody could drop in, you know, it was, and did drop in. There might be 10 or 15 people in the kitchen for tea at some time, and the tea had to be boiled just properly, you know. It would be half the boiling put on and sit for 5 minutes and sit, and they'd do all kinds of cakes and donuts and things. And I don't know, they never seemed to run out of anything. And the garage was the meeting place for most people. They'd come and sit around the old hot little stove and tell their lies and jokes and things like that. And before it was a garage, though, and they used to have a stable there, all box stars, where they, hut and stars, where they could bring people used to come across with their horses and things like that, and then take the train to town, and then back again, take them home again, and go across the ice in the wintertime, and then they'd try bird just at the window. So it was always quite a meeting place, and always a bunch of characters around there. Well, it was just fun just to be there as kids, you know. Sometimes you have to be kicked out as kids, but chauffeurs, when they were, in the olden days, there was very few cars in Rossi, but the chauffeurs that would come out from St. John to visit, they would always go there to spend the time when they were waiting for their people. So it was just always a whole bunch of people that were around there. It was a fun place to be. Kennedy House, as I remember.
Who were some of the people who you had? Did one of those young pictures, he could be young.
Michael Arthur.
And were they pretty much the only people?
Yes, they had help off and on. They had different people, and they were, like I can remember, Nellie Orr was a great, great worker there, and then Mrs. Dobbin was, and people that were there were, they always were so friendly and nice to get along with. I don't know, they just seemed to be great. My uncle was a great person with people, and especially women, and his comebacks were fast. And one time, after he moved out of the hotel, he was living in his own home, he called me one day and he said, my lawnmower's not working as yours. And I said, sure it is. said, well, if you bring it down, I could use it. I said, well, I'll come down and mow your lawn for you. So when I finished mowing the lawn, he came out the door, and I was just putting the lawnmower back in the car. And he said, how much do I owe you? Well, I said, Mr. Kendi, I charge the same thing as I charge the accountant and the lawyer. That's $100 an hour. Well, worth it, he said, just, you know, just like that. And the woman next door was sunbathing there, and she jumped up to the door to look at who this clown was charging $100 an hour. Well, God, I left. And he left. And, you know, it was like that all the time. I just quick and
witty.
And witty. And his, that was his whole life, I think. He did most things for nothing, really. He, in fact, he charged $3 to go to Tampa. He wouldn't even pay his time. And, and his hotel there, he never charged enough. But,
I heard that.
He wouldn't put up. I told him one time, I said, you aren't losing money on this. And he wouldn't put that. He wouldn't charge him anything.
Okay.
Tell me about your golfing and experience and your golf camping club and it also burned in the fire. Tell me what the old book is like. Well, my first introduction to the golf course was my next door neighbor, J. Royden Thompson, who was a character. Came over one day and he said, you're going to the golf club. I said, no, I'm not going to the golf club. So he went to my mother and said, we need caddies down there. And I want him, oh yes, just get him down there. So I went down there and I caddied for this old woman, and she was a nice lady, but she didn't hit the ball very far, and I thought, oh, what a boring game this is. And then I later on, and in that same game, I saw one of the ladies in the last year hit the ball pretty good, and so I said, oh, that's not bad, you know, you get to like this game, maybe. So as caddies, we were allowed to play in the morning from 6 o'clock on till 9 o'clock. In those days, I never started playing until 9 o'clock. That's how I get interested in golf, and it just became a big part of my life. Just couldn't get away from it. It's something that
That's
fun
for you.
Huh?
It's what you
need. Oh, yeah. It's a great thing to do when you're retired, too, because you need the exercise and things like that. So it's something that you can do all your life until you're ready for the grave.
Okay. What was the old building?
Well, it was a beautiful old building. And it had a great big sunroom veranda on it that looked out over the river. Mm-hmm. And the ladies used to go there on tea day and play bridge there. And we used to be down as caddies down in the river swimming, and we used to have a raft there and things like that, and of course we didn't have any bathing suits. So one day they complained about this, the women did, and they were croaking down to give us help. But one of the fellows saw in time, we'd offer, there was a bunch of boxes there, offer boxes overhead, and just like the rocks were floating around, he couldn't find us, so he had no, he had an excuse on his life, so there's nobody down there. So. And they had a lovely fireplace and a main hall for dancing and things like that. Upstairs with a beautiful view of the river and a nice view of the golf course itself outside, so you could see both things. No, not all around, but they would be in the sun porch part all around there. But upstairs in the bar, there were a lot of windows. And then they had a sit-out area with an awning over it, and facing the golf course. So you could sit there and enjoy watching the other players come in and maybe powering up and adding to it. Mm-hmm. So it was fun, you know.
Now, how many people would have been in the golf course back then?
Well, it seems like there's about 10 to 1 now, but I don't think it was that many. I'm not sure how many members we got to play golf. That's about $700 or $800 to play golf, but not all the time. And in those days, I imagine it would be, well, there must have been 200 women and men. But I don't know for sure what's fun.
Well,
it's fun in those days because everybody took a caddy. And it wasn't very expensive, so they could. Nowadays, there's nobody that does caddy, and so you have to walk. Lug your own car going right in a golf cart. But it was fun in those days because all the caddies had their favorite player, and they became very attached to that player, and it was the height that broke out when you were.
I don't know if this is the price. How much was the price that Martin was
the first price that I can remember as a senior golfer was $65 a year. Now it's about $12,000. And then in those days, a junior could play for $5 a year, which would be good. You could always scrape up $5 to other limits in some time. And then we had an offer of a big bunch of caddies that could play golf pretty well because of, you know, being allowed to play. So when they became of age to get out of junior, the people at Riverside then that were running the club were far-sighted enough to say, well, we should keep some of these guys in golf, so they made an intermediate membership for $15 a year. And boy, we all grabbed onto that. And most of those fellows now are, you know, have contributed to golf all over the place, you know, in Vancouver, Kingston, Ontario, Halifax. They've all, you know, been involved in golf in the highest running clubs and vice presidents and things like that, and on the board of directors. So, you know, they really appreciate it, I think, golf.
Speaking of presidents, who ran the golf club back then and who runs it now, or how was it delegated, like authority?
Well,
it's a change of frequency.
Yes. We used to have a person at Riverside, the name of Sid Stewart. And when I first went there, he was the assistant pro to Vernon Balch. And then he became the pro, and then he became the manager, and then he became the pro manager, and then he became everything. And he did everything. And he looked after the payroll, and he looked after the food thing, and then he did everything. And I think when he died, I think there were 5 men to replace him. He was the one that was really in charge. He did everything. And we had a great number of caddies there in those days, and he was a disciplinarian. And everybody listened to him. He was a disciplinarian, but he was a lovely person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, one more question about the golf course assembly. Now, I haven't got very many who has worked on the golf course and really built it? Like, the physical landscape.
We had a greenskeeper there named Bill Gilliland. And in the 1930s, he was, I suppose, restricted in his budget. But along came Percy Thompson, and he was a multimillionaire. And he asked the board of directors if he could work on the golf course and bring it up, and he would have his own crew, but he would also help Mr. Gilliland when he needed. So they became, I think, pretty good friends, and he was involved in really building the golf course into a championship golf course then, and he hired an architect from Pinehurst, Pitt, North Carolina, who was the best in the world and has never, you know, been caught. His name is Donald J. Ross. And he used to come up here and stay with Mr. Thompson once in a while, and it cost him quite a bit of money per day. I remember him telling us how much it was, and I won't say what it was, but mm-hmm. In those days it was a huge amount of money. He would come up here and look over the thing and make the plan and saw it. And Mr. Thompson, I also take Mr. Gilliland, who was the greenskeeper, to all these meetings of turf conferences and things like that, which we never, I don't think anybody ever dreamed that they would go to. And so they say that Mr. Gilliland became one of the best draftsmen in Canada, being going to all these things. He was kind of quite a gardener too. He grew a nice vegetable in the garden and things like that. So, he was just such a great old fellow. He was just there doing things, and he got the glass work. And then other people came along.
Mm-hmm. How many employees are there?
Well, in the old days, I think that there were, each person had three holes to look after. So I think there were six. And they did everything. They mowed the fairways, and they mowed the grain, and they dug out the weeds by hand. And that was quite a chore. And they looked after the whole thing. They raked their own bunkers, and they worked hard. Really hard. Now today, plowed under the machine. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why don't you tell me a little about winter and on the river and the activities that we have?
Well, first of all, I'm going to tell you about the sliding.
Okay.
Because they don't have any more of that. I never see anybody sliding on sleds hardly everywhere. And in those days, it was, everybody had their own sled and they polished it, and they thought it was the best thing there ever was. And one time we were sliding up in Fairvale, and come down, and in the old days there was an S-turn there. You had to go under an underpass. Mm-hmm. And the old bus was coming up, and the voice of us going underneath that. Because the bus in those days was quite high. So a couple of guys that had the low sleds went right underneath the bus, and they scared the bus driver. But every night we'd be sliding somewhere around Ross here, and there'd be a bunch of them. I don't know how many. And usually, somewhere, they would, when it was time to quit, they'd go in whoever house it was, and they'd have maybe a hot cocoa or something like that. And in the old days, they used to have a road marked across the river there with, put in little trees all the way along. And that was the roadway that they used. Guys, and we have to get off the road. And I don't know whether it was colder in those days or rough, but it seemed to me that there was all kinds of skating on the river and hockey and things. There used to be a little pond down in here, which was driven from the wind by the railroad. And that's where we played most of the time. Other than that, and then the river there. But we'd skate all over the river. Okay. Well, I remember that they said you put a hot potato in your shoes when you come back to, keep them warm. You didn't.
What type of sled did you use?
Well, there was two sleds that were really good. One was a flexible flyer, and the other was a speedster. And the flexible flyer had a runner that was concave, and the speedster had a round runner, and it was better on ice, but the other one was better on snow.
So, the
runners,
would it be wooden
outside? Wooden top, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then my uncle used to say a lot of those things, so we used to have to slide on biscuit boxes. In the olden days.
Yeah.
I always talk about the old days.
Yeah. They often did. Okay.
Then we used to have horse races over on the river here at Justin Royal, right in front there.
He
used to have horse races there, and they used to all go over there, and in the early days they'd be in their horses racing over. not race horses. And then I remember they used to have them once in a while after that when their cars came in, and then they used to race the cars over there. But some days it would be enough snow that they'd have to get out of the horse and just do a little drift. But it was, memorable things.
What? Wouldn't the car,
Snow
cap?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But they were higher in those days, so they could go through a lot of snow. And they had chains on. No, her name.
Oh, yeah. Father's son. Carnival.
Carnival, oh. Well, yeah,
where would it take place?
Down on the river, I think here.
The Carnival?
Yeah.
What carnival is
there? Well, the carnival would be a passion carnival, and it would be once a year. And we'd all go on that day, and if the ice was good enough, we could see it. And if it wasn't, we could run around. But one year, I remember, Gord Bobbs ran the rink and did a good job. And a couple of more of the old fellows around there said, come here, we're going to rush up for the carnival. You know, said, okay, we took me down. They're dressing up as one of the old characters. And found that I scared to death. I thought this fellow would come along and see me and recognize me and beat me up. Anyway, I won first prize and got out of it without being caught. So.
There you go. You did well.
They got a big kick out of it. They knew I was scared to death.
That's probably why they instigated it.
There used to be a whole bunch of characters around here, you know.
Tell me some of them.
I suppose it's too expensive to be a character now, but when I think back to Harry Green, Andy's brother, who was a plumber and a philosopher, and I think the strongest man I've ever seen, I saw him pick up a car one time, so, yeah. Nellie Francis, who's an Indian woman, so you ever heard
of her? Oh, yes, I've heard of it. Tell me the story, but I always
get
you one. Tell me what you know about.
Well, I knew her and her son, Frankie. He was a real athlete. He had an unfortunate death. He poisoned himself with blood and booze. But in the days that I knew him, he didn't drink or smoke or anything, and he was as straight as a ramrod and just about the best physical specimen around here. And he could run like a deer, and he could do anything else. But, you know, he had the strength, but unfortunately, he didn't need him. He didn't get too much. She was a strong woman. She was a little portly, but a strong woman. There are legends about her on the train.
No, are they not appropriate?
And then Corey Williams, who was the head operator in the telephone company down there, I don't think she was there forever. No, until automatic thing comes in and that's the survey out of it.
Those ladies must have been thrifty.
Yeah, yeah.
It's impossible to realize how much they had to be aware and how fast they would have to work. And it would be a very strenuous day. I mean, people who weren't in the interior properly and give them a hard time.
But they were always there with the information you could call them for the time or anything. You know, in those days, everybody didn't have cops or what. And then there was old Ike Dobbin, who worked on the railway here, that always had a story. And,
what
did
he work on?
Some other things.
What did he do for
it? Well, he used to be the rocker, I guess, the superintendent.
The inspector.
Rock the railway, the inspector. And then he was retired when, after that. And there's a lot of rumors going around. then there was Joe Henderson. He was the builder here, and he built a home and gave up. And he had, and we got off.
Is that what he did?
Yeah, he was straight up off. And then, of course, Rupert Turnbull, the inventor, and, you know, again, Norm Deagle, the storekeeper there. This is where all the kids from the RCS would gather, and they'd have their nose guard at the time. They called it Arctic Sunbar. It would be like a revel only no stick on it, and made by the Sussex Butter Company. And it's a real ice cream, you know, covered by chocolate. And, it's, oh, beautiful. And then they had their raisin cakes, you know, that's where they would get them.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be eating those things. Us local boys couldn't afford those things, so they'd just stand around with their tongue kind of like
that. Being jealous.
Yeah. And then there was my mother. She did everything. She was a mother, cook, seamstress, knitter, gardener, bookkeeper, disciplinarian, and friend of ours. She had, I don't think in the 20s, I can remember when the people that drove the rods came here. And I don't know how they knew it, but they always landed up in our harbor. And there's never once that any of those people ever went away without something. So...
Tell me about swimming at the Rossing Wharf.
I only did a little bit of it there because after I got interested in golf, I did very little swimming.
Sure. Tell me a little bit more about it.
Well, I remember we used to go down there and try to impress the girls with our bows. It wasn't very good. And swimming there until when I was young there until I was the last bottle of blood in my body and cold and wet. And the other things that used to be an old lady used to come down and sit there. One day we had planned ahead and we had overturned the boat. And then we all dove in and out, got under the boat to see what's in the cave. And outside of that, I don't really have any recollections much of swimming. Down in the beaches where you were used to allowed to go on the beaches, now the people that live there won't let you go. Used to do quite a bit of swimming on the beaches. That was a lot easier today. But for the real guys.
Oh.
But that's what I love, and then after that I didn't do much swimming, so.
What about houses lost in Boston?
You never lost a house here because I was on the fire department.
There you go, absolutely. That's right. I heard that was a volunteer fire department, and that it was the best little fire department you could find because they had a chemical machine, and one time at St. John's, people came, and they're going, so where do we hook the pumps up? And they go, there's no pumps, so they ended up in a little fire.
Right. It was a little Model T Ford, and it had the soda and mixer, and had to break the bottle, mix it up, and then you could spray the fire.
What would be the chemical? Soda and
what? And something else. I really don't know what else it was. I forget now. I knew in those days, but it's so long ago, I forget. But the other thing is, most of the fires were chimney fires in those days. And so they would just get up and throw the salt on the chimney and put the fire out and everything else would fall down. And some of them, if they're well built, they could let it burn. Right. Mm-hmm. And but we did lose some fires. And one that I remember very vividly was the Walter Austin house down there. And when we got there, after the town had a put in the hydrants and things. When we got there, get up to the house, and then we were taking the hose back to the thing, and we had it back in too. So then we had to reverse the whole hose one time, and that was it. But the fire had started in the coal bin, and the coal bin was cherry red, it had burned quite a while. And the rest of it was full of this dark, a yellowish, smoky light on the coal fire. A lot of the fellows were going in the safe and things like that. And when they opened that door and they hit that smoke hit them, it nearly knocked them out. I remember Murray Howe, the barber, he was another character.
Mm-hmm.
And we just got him out of there and pulled him out of there, and he was coughing, and I thought, this stuff is so thick, I don't know how he could get it. So anyway, the first thing they grabbed was the grand piano, and they got it stuck in the doorway, so they never got anything out of that house.
Oh,
dear. It was a beautiful house, quite a lot. And we lost a few of the country, but I think we did a pretty good job with the fire department.
Most of us did fairly. Tell me, the barber, that company. Where was the barber shop? What was it like? What went on? Well, it was above the fire, where the fireplace is, fire department is now, is it not?
No.
No? Where was it?
It was over where the Consolidated School was, or the now the Park School. And it was a little building that housed town equipment. And later a town tractor. It just had the equipment in there. The fire truck there was in another part. And up over this place was the barb shop, and they had a potbelly stove, and very steep stairs going up to it. And I remember when I was a child, this is my first introduction to him, I had long curly hair, and I wound them off because the boys in school were giving me a hard time. And so I went in and asked him to cut my hair. He said, "No, I couldn't cut your hair without your mother's permission." And he laughed in a funny way. Like he would say, he would keep downstairs and make a lot of noise. Say, "What's the idea of all the sound?" You know, that kind of thing. And he would be cutting your hair there. And there'd be a card game going on.
Oh,
he'd be
right.
Cutting the hair and watching the card game, see? So you never knew what kind of haircut you got. But he was a nice fellow. You know, he was a character that I never forget, but I never marked him down. And people in there, and there'd be all kinds of characters like Iron American, and you know, they had to go out somewhere else and come back here to retire. Told their stories in there. And play Option 45 in there, and everybody had fun.
Did it have the spittoon?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Speaking of spittoons, the Rinkers had a round hole, no bigger than that. And Harry Darkus could sit about, I suppose, about 8-10 feet away from it, and never miss it. Right into that hole. I don't know how he did it. All the other guys caught it, of course, they were splattered all around it. Anyway, he was the best I'd ever seen. But spittoons, there were spittoons everywhere you went. No, okay, so, you know, spittoons. I chewed tobacco once, I was trying to impress the power. I put the back in my mouth, and I think the juice has come from everywhere. They explode in your mouth. No, in those days there were spittoons. I don't think there was a place in the hotel or anywhere that wasn't spittoons.
Tell me about the Indians of Sandy Beach. Dominic, Nellie Francis, Frankie Francis, Basket Weaving, Lawn Furniture, Bows and Arrows, and Laughing Louie, and the acting was just...
And Laughing Louie ended up in Fairvale there, and everybody was scared to death of him because it was rumored that he could do here and he'd throw a max. And he was good at it because he was good and it would stick right into the tree beside your head or something like that. I never saw him do that. Well, he used to say to the boys when they did get in to see him, that, "You bring me grub, I make you a damn fine pair of skis." You know, he'd make them a pair of skis or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know whether he ever did it or not, because the boy just said that he told him that I never went skiing. So never pair a little skier anyway, you know, and I was it.
Yeah.
And, of course, Nellie and Frankie, and a lot of Nellie's stories you couldn't tell because...
She was basically quite a rat.
She was quite a rough woman, but a nice woman. And her hut, her earth floor was clean to the she was quite a nice person in the home. And
what would their huts be of? Like, was it like a wigwam or a teepee, or was it like boards, or was it a lean-to? Or?
Yes, it was boards and oil signs and anything you could find that keep the wind up. You weren't always attractive, no. Then, but the other Indians that I knew, in the summertime, we used to go over to Kingston to stay and live there. And there was a group of Indians, the Powells and the tribe, used to come there and stay and make baskets and things on the beach over there. So we were pretty friendly with those. And they would do anything for you. And there was one guy there, I'd never seen it before, and I've never seen one since, but he had a slingshot, not an ordinary slingshot, with a rod. It was just one that he held, and he let go of one end of it. And he could nail things with that thing, just as He could even make him skip across the water and things like that. And I don't, I've never seen anybody do that since, but I've, you know, I've heard about it.
It's like on a one stick, is it?
No, it was just a piece of leather. And he tore both ends and he threw like that and let one end go and the thing would just be a back of this anyway. And I could do it. I had to let the both ends go. And he could do it.
It must have not really been a piece of leather, but how you
pour
emotion. Isn't that interesting?
And then those people would sit around and talk at night, have a bonfire, and the person would get down. My brother Bill had a broken leg, and they had put things in, like the road, DVDs, and they'd make a big thing in DVDs. And so, and they were, you know, pretty friendly people.
A lot of people were scared of them, but they weren't really that
bad. Oh, no, they were very nice. You know, I suppose later on, there were, when the economy made them, you know, get out of that basket weaving thing, thinking that they were all living their dreams or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think it's like a growing. Mm-hmm.
See, we're supposed to have Indian blood now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, from way back in the woods factory.
So it's my uncle's wife. We have attractive eyes here, but I think it was because I think it's so sweet. And the love of us in the community, and the flowers, and just what we're going for. And the flaws of family have been shown. The mother is definitely something like a flaw, that's something that
and then another Indian that was very dear to our family was Dick Bass. And he was from Shubenacadie. And he came to work with us in the household. And he did the chores around for mother and things like that. And he could peel potatoes. And I'm telling you, the peeling wouldn't be as thick as the fingernail. And they were just when he would cut the wood in the wintertime with an axe. And when he cut the stump, it just looked like it had been shaved plain or something like that. That's how accurate he was. I often wonder if you could get a guy like that and put him on the golf course, he'd probably be so active that he could do anything.
Yeah, like just the way he looked.
Yeah, the way the natural ability to put the same place all the time. So he was there quite a while, and I think he's dead now, but he was alive a few years ago, and my brother Dick kept in touch with him, but he don't know what to do. He was disgusted with the new breed Indians now.
Definitely.
They couldn't do anything at all, I think. He'd make a vice out of wood. Mm-hmm. Run by your feet, like, you know. He just get a tree and cut a slot in the tree and get another piece of wood, put a head on it, put that down through the slot, and then use his feet to push that way, and then he put underneath it, would be caught in a jam between the log and the head of the thing. And he'd push it. And he'd make a draw knife out of it, and he would discard a farm and all that. He'd make a draw knife out of that. And, he made all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He made all of his own axe handles.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people were here then, for the Indians. Well, the Indians brother came to that. So, I mean, that's where they picked the Indians. You know, they didn't know if they could
meet out. No, I think the Indians made them all from the first.
Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. They supplied with meat for a community that, you know, they wouldn't have been able to do with that.
You know, actually, Moses be business people. They really had to have access to it. Couldn't survive burning wood. Not like turn on the old electricity. The old fire going.
Isn't it is interesting to me that they supply the meat and put nobody else with. So, there's no news today. Okay. Tell me about the rough and so forth. Now, I've got a surprise for you. You're going to be impressed. Brian Kurtz. Work for Tom Bell. Kathy Morton worked for the Hollies. Joe McHugh worked for F.B. Scott, John Dobbin worked for Percy Johnson, Murray Fraser worked for Mrs. Doris Taylor, Ray Butler worked for Mr. W. Mackay Sr., Warren Randall worked for Walter Allison, and we don't know, but Archie Morton might have worked for Jim. Tell me what the chauffeurs were like. What kind of things did they do?
I think they all tried to play tricks on one another. And one trick I saw played one time was one of their chauffeurs getting around. They put a jack under one of the cars and just lifted the hind wheel off just enough so it wouldn't touch. It didn't have a tip. And when the guy got into the back out of where he was, this is a chauffeur that wore gloves all the time, right gloves, and put the right gloves on, gets the car going, puts in reverse, turns around and back up, and didn't move. And he just went right as his gloves. He was scared to death of his people. So that was one of the tricks that I did. And the chauffeurs always used to congregate up there when the planes had their garden party. Yeah, the planes had a garden party. And they used to have a great big huge bowl in the ice house. Ice houses in those days were
a little more common than
that. Yeah. And they used to have this. They'd take the sawdust away. They put this great big bowl in there, and it would be full of punch. And that's the way it kept full there. And then, I thought it was a huge bowl, because they'd take it over there and take it down to another bowl. And that's where the trouble is. We tried to sneak in one day. And they didn't like it when we were kids, but the chauffeurs found out how to put the run.
The chauffeurs must actually have all been pretty good friends, because most of the people they would drive would all go to things that we would see each other.
Well, they were always friendly. It was like they were sacred.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Any of those chauffeurs you speak of, what did they do for this? They were handymen, or were they just chauffeurs?
Well, I think they did. They're supposed to be chauffeurs, but I think they did the handyman stuff and worked inside the house and grass and clean windows. They did windows and all that. I think they did a lot of things. I don't know for sure, but I think they did.
Okay. Did you go to the rest of the building?
Yeah.
What
was? Well, the first memory, I have is Mr. McMurray, grade one teacher, who was, the best you could ever want. She did everything, you know, almost blow your nose for you and things, you know. She was, I don't know, you remember her, and I don't know what you could say about her. She maintained discipline, and she had a lot of fun in her classroom, things like that, and then had some other teachers there, and Laura Howard, when she wanted to punish you, she'd grab you by the chin and shake you like that until she started crying, and then that was it. So, and I suppose you're supposed to feel sorry for her. And then Miss Smith, who was quite a girl. And then Miss Pasco, who is now on the school board, same time? I see it. Anyway, he was our teacher, and he's still working at going strong. But the thing I think that I remember most about, or I'm proud of, or something like that, is that everybody went there. And it didn't matter whether they were Catholic, or Jews, or Indians, or Protestants, or whatever. It was just a school. Worked together and played together, and I don't think I ever heard any comment by anybody in that school, you know, you dirty punks or you. I don't think I ever heard anything like that. There was a lot of fights at times, you know, when things would break out, but I never heard. I don't remember anything ever hearing anything like that. But I went to St. John. I never used. Well, it was hard to get the same time up. We kept on the train when we were young, before the buses and things. So, to me, it was just I just get sort of locked out when they start saying, oh, you know, we need our own schools, we need our own this and that, our heritage, or losing this, or losing that. We all worked together and had a good time, and I think everybody feels the same way about one another now as it did then. You know.
Like everybody.
Yeah. It was just a melting pot of everybody, and they just got along great.
Yeah, did you graduate from the school, or did you leave in grade 8, like the Buckle? I heard a lot of people left
in the school. I didn't graduate because I broke my leg, and I was out of school for a while, and I went back to try it again.
A lot of people, well, you didn't eat it.
It wasn't the thing that they fascinated in those days. The technology wasn't that great, and they could get along.
They had a lot more common sense than that.